Winter Republic, Chapter 2, Pestera. "Hey, all right," says Thomas, as he follows Antinous through the doorway of the Pestera. The space inside is about 10 meters across by 20 long, with golden light filtering down from industrial metal-shaded lamps through a transparent haze of cigarette smoke. A makeshift concrete top bar stands on the far side of the room across from the door, and a DJ spins from a pair of decks on a rusting steel operating room table toward the back wall. Behind the DJ is a large poster depicting the head and shoulders of a smiling cartoon fat man in what looks like a Hawaiian shirt. Around the cartoon man's neck is drawn a necklace of hand grenades, the letters RGD5 printed in Cyrillic on each of their smooth, oblong faces. The word Explodo stretches above the man's head in bold Roman sans serifs. The DJ under the Explodo sign seems to know what he's doing. Mellow beats fill the space, and though there are really too many tables in the way to make a proper dance floor, some of the 24 people in the room are swaying to the music anyway. Looks like a good crowd, young and colorful, despite all the difficulties Thomas has heard about life as a citizen in Crimea. Suddenly, the hassle at the airport doesn't bother him anymore. Suddenly, he's in quite a downtempo mood. "Downtempo," he says, smiling at Antinous. "Yeah, man, downtempo. I like this place." Thomas and Antinous shrug out of their coats and walk to the bar. The bartender is a 1.5 meters tall girl with short, dark hair and artificially long eyelashes, wearing a white tank top and camouflage skirt. She leans forward across the bar so Antinous can give her a quick kiss on the mouth.
"Luba, this is Thomas. He's the famous American writer I told you about."
Antinous drags Thomas to the bar by one arm.
"I am sorry, my English not so good." Luba takes Thomas's hand and blushes.
"Hey, no problem. My Russian isn't so hot either," Thomas says in Russian.
"And I'm not famous."
He glances darkly at Antinous. Luba laughs and relaxes, then continues in Russian.
"Хорошо, хорошо. But your Russian sounds fine to me. You're American, yes? What is America like these days?"
"I can't imagine it's fucking wine and roses, but I wouldn't know. I moved to London years ago."
"Ah, I have always wanted to live in London. There is good music there."
"Yeah, the scene is great, but London is just getting too expensive. I've been spending more time in Russia lately than the UK anyway. Maybe I should just give up and move east."
"Yes, you should move east. Come here and live with us in Simferopol."
Luba smiles and blushes again.
"You must have a girl in every city in Europe. That is why all you writers want to travel. Yes? All the girls?"
Thomas has heard this myth before and laughs. "No, it's not like that at all. Trust me on this one."
"Thomas is a hard-working journalist. He has no time for girls," adds Antinous.
"I'm sorry about little Luba here, Thomas. She is young and naive."
"Oh, yeah, and you're old and decrepit, so you're gonna die before I do," shouts Luba.
Antinous rocks back and clutches his chest in a mock heart attack.
"So, Thomas," Luba turns to him and continues mildly, "are you writing about us for a newspaper?"
"It's a contract for the Invisible Hand. He tries to think of a way to make this bit seem sexy. It's a British business magazine. I'm here to write a story about energy politics in the Crimea."
"Ah."
Luba's eyes instantly glaze over, and her smile fades. "You've never heard of the Invisible Hand, have you?"
No.
"How about Transitions Online, Metropolia, Passport Magazine? No?" She shakes her head at each name.
"Don't you ever work for anyone important? Anyone I might have heard of? Like CNN?
No, Thomas mumbles.
"Well, I don't know if it counts, but Christiane Amanpour once stole a taxi from me right in front of Hotel Slavyanskaya in Moscow. She just walked out in front of me and, took it."
Luba continues to stare blankly at him.
"Well, I'm sorry, but I don't have British beer. All we have is Slavutich."
"Actually, something clear would be perfect," Thomas says.
"Я тоже выпью водки, пожалуйста," says Антинус.
After Luba returns with a pair of vodka tonics, Thomas and Antinous find seats at a free table.
"Could you sound any more boring? Listen to you, business magazine."
Antonis scolds. You should have told her you were working for Wallpaper or Mixmag or something. Sometimes with women you must lie. Yeah, sure. Hey, Andy, what's up with the language? I thought people would be speaking Ukrainian because of the geography, but everyone's speaking Russian. Yes, Russian was supposed to be the main language in Crimea after it became independent, but a lot of Ukrainians live here. Crimea was Russian territory till Khrushchev gave it to the Ukraine as a gift in the 50s. But the local dialect sounds Ukrainian anyway, Thomas mentions. Yes, exactly. It's a mess. Everyone has to learn two alphabets and three languages if you count English. We'll all be geniuses in a few years. I'm a genius. Can't you tell? Thomas sips his drink and smiles. The DJ has switched tracks to something mellow and smooth. An echoing low-frequency buzz in the track sinks steadily into the pleasure sensors in the back of his head. It reminds him of the San Francisco club scene. Good nights, when dancing to the right music had been the only thing that mattered to him, and the future had still seemed like a kind place, like an infinite blue sky. That was a hell of a long time ago. How long has this place been open? He asks, to avoid thinking about the past. More than 30 years, I should think, though it never looked like this in the old days. During Soviet time, it was a dissident cafe. Very secret place, very dark and smoky. That's why they used to call it Peshtera, the cave. Thomas watches Antonis smile and survey the room. Peshtera. We made a lot of big plans here 10, 15 years ago. After independence and the time of troubles, we had a chance to start a new democratic system, but none of the dissident parties could agree with each other. We were too young and stupid. We didn't have any experience. The West didn't know or care that we existed, and we let Chernyarukov and his black shirts roll all over us. By the mid-1990s, most of the intellectuals and the old ex-Soviet dissidents just gave up and left the country. Losing so many people took the heart out of the protest movement, though I can't blame them for leaving while they could. We were worried about reprisals then. Where did they go? Thomas asks. A lot of them kept their Soviet passports and converted them to Russian or Ukrainian citizenship. Some of the others got out of the Commonwealth completely, ended up in Canada or the U.S. I'm still in touch with some of them. You ever heard of Vika Saltykova? I hear she's running some kind of political consultancy in Toronto now. Runs an image company. Thomas shakes his head, lighting another Ruski steel. No, I guess not. She was a little older than I, Vika, my mentor in the protest movement. She always kept me safe, held me back from going too far and getting hurt. But the sad smile and distant look in Antonis' eyes tells Thomas that there was more to it than that. It doesn't seem that people here are too worried about that bomb. Thomas gestures at the crowd. Nah, not here, not anymore. Peshtera went above ground a few years ago. I still like it, but the crowd is mostly kids now. Life has been so hard the last few years that most people have given up on politics. Especially the kids. Honestly, Antonis, Thomas says, sometimes I wish I could be more like that. These kids are lucky. Thomas savors the vodka and watches two tall party girls dance slowly with each other in the corner of the room, hands in each other's hair. Yeah, I hope they stay lucky. If there's some kind of new unrest starting, Chernyarukov will use it to solidify his own power, Antonis says. But I thought Chernyarukov was a nationalist. How does a bomb going off in Simferopol help him? I mean, it just points out a failure of his own security, doesn't it? No, Antonis says. Now he can act patriotic and tell people that if they don't support him, they support the terrorists. It's working for your genius President Bush, isn't it? Thomas nods soberly into his glass. Yes, it is. Chernyarukov is not as stupid as he looks, Antonis says. In the 1980s, he was just a low-level apparatchik in the Crimean administration, when we were still part of the Union. When everything fell apart, he experienced some kind of overnight miracle and then acted like he was a lifelong Crimean patriot. He played the Russians against the Ukrainians and said we faced a life-and-death struggle for the soul of Crimea. There was no real struggle except the one Chernyarukov invented, but it was smart politics because he could accuse us moderates of being unpatriotic. The country probably never would have become independent without the NF, but it's hard to say whether we're better off for it now. What's the NF? Thomas asks. Narodny Front. It's the pro-independence party Chernyarukov started. The only ones who really support them anymore are pensioners, the army, maybe some gangs of skinheads. Football fans, too, maybe.
Football fans?
Yeah, Chernorukov owns Krymskoye Plamya, the country's most popular football team.
Thomas grunts.
Yeah, I know, says Antonis. But so far, it's been enough. Everyone with half a brain knows Chernorukov is robbing the country blind while watching the economy fall apart, but...
Antonis lights a Prima, pulls deeply, exhales, and shrugs.
You can't talk too loud in public here. Two guys I knew from the movement disappeared a few years ago. One of them turned up in a field with two bullets in the back of his head. The other one left work one day and hasn't been heard from since. You heard about what happened to Ganganzi up in Ukraine? Here in Crimea, it's been even worse. The country is in trouble, Thomas. It feels like it's coming apart faster every day. The only reason no one in the West knows about it is because we're a small country, and none of the big Western companies have financial interest in us yet.
Jesus Christ, says Thomas.
Don't blaspheme.
I hadn't heard any of this before.
Well, the message board where you and I met is only secure to a point, says Antonis. I couldn't send you too much detail in public. I did tell you it might be hard to get a story here.
Well, I guess I'll just have to look harmless.
Harmless, sure. You're a foreigner, and that gives you some immunity if you're careful.
Antonis leans forward and lowers his voice.
Chernorukov is obviously pulling the strings of the local organizatsiya, but some very shady Russian characters have also been buying up waterfront property on the Black Sea coast for the last 10 years.
The Russian organizatsiya is laundering money through Crimean real estate deals?
Antonis shrugs. Either that, or they really like the beaches.
And let me guess, Thomas says. Chernorukov owns the banks that are financing the deals, so he can rake a percentage off the top.
Chernorukov is a bad guy. Don't fuck with him unless you have to, Antonis says.
Are you going to?
Going to what?
Fuck with Chernorukov.
Not unless I have to, Thomas grins.
What is your plan?
I'm just here for the economy story. I know that there's a power plant on the West Coast that's being financed with European money, and I'll use that as an introduction to the state of the Crimean economy. Since a failed economy means a failed state, I'll say that an implosion in Crimea would expose the rest of Europe to risks that they might not be ready for. Politics being what they are, I imagine Chernorukov's people will be unthrilled about what I have to say.
Antonis frowns, looking down at his cigarette.
Fine. Fine. I'll help you if I can. A little more attention on Crimea would help us, to the extent we can still be helped.
He looks up and stares at Thomas deeply through the haze of cigarette smoke. Thomas looks away, nodding slowly and processing the information. He watches the bar without seeing it for a moment, then notices Luba leaning forward to hand vodka tonics to two young girls in sequin tank tops. That scene seems out of place now.
You came in on a press visa, Thomas?
Antonis catches his attention again.
I did, yes. I had to sort it out in London before I left for Russia.
How long did they give you?
I need 2 weeks to get the story about the economy, but my visa's good for a month, just in case.
Thomas tries to remember the date he left London for Petersburg, what his apartment looked like, the last time he saw his roommate, and what they might have spoken about. All of it, already so distant.
That means the authorities know you're in town, and that you will be asking questions, says Antonis.
Don't ask too many questions, you understand me?
Antonis blows smoke into the air and laughs, a short, cynical chuckle. Welcome to my country.
Thanks for the advice, Antonis. What about you? Have you had any problems?
Not really. I know how to stay out of the way of the black shirts, and I'm careful about who I talk to. Some of the new people in the democracy movement say we're moving too slow. But political change will take a long time here. Crimea is not the Baltics.
Yeah, I covered the Baltics from Vilnius before the last NATO enlargement. I liked it there. Fun town. Laid-back people.
You wrote me about it before, says Antonis. You didn't know that I'm Lithuanian myself?
Oh, yeah?
Yes, it's true. My family was from Vilnius originally. My grandparents were resettled to Ukraine in the 1950s.
So why are you still here?
What am I supposed to do in Vilnius? I don't know anyone there. Probably everybody my grandparents knew were resettled or worse. I speak Lithuanian well enough, but if I went back, everyone would hear my accent and think I was Russian. Meanwhile, a lot of people here call me the Lithuanian. It's a joke, man. That sounds like a pretty bad joke. Nah, not really. I do fine. I have my friends here. Young people these days don't care about the past. The world is changing. And these people, he gestures to the party kids, talking, smoking, grooving on the beats. The two tall girls in the corner dance slowly, staring meaningfully into each other's faces. The future belongs to these people, Thomas. Not Chernorukov. And not us either. We grew up during the Cold War. It twisted us, all those years we spent waiting for the bomb to drop. I think we're fucked for good. Antonis takes a long pull on his Prima and stares at Thomas with red-rimmed eyes, swaying just slightly. Why are you here, Thomas?
I told you, it's my assignment. I was interested.
No, don't fuck around with me. All the places you could go, and you found me. You came here. Why put up with this place? Money? No money. You'd cry if I told you. Seriously. Girls? You know a girl here?
No.
You're a spy, then. Tell me.
Thomas smiles and gulps the last of his vodka tonic.
As you say, Antonis, you and I are products of the Cold War. When I was 17, I watched the Berlin Wall come down on CNN. I was still in high school, and I was crazy about the world then, crazy for all the adventure that I thought was out there waiting for me, all the cities and people, and I watched those German kids dancing on the wall, pulling it down with their hands and their music, changing history, and I felt that this was the party of all parties, and I wasn't there. I was sitting alone in my parents' armchair in the States, just watching it happen. I decided that if the world was going to change again, I would be there when it did. I wasn't going to miss the next big party.
Antonis nods along with Thomas's words.
You're a romantic, Thomas. Mother of heaven, you must be the last of them.
All the shit that's landed on us since, Thomas says, I never fell out of love with the world.
He selects another Ruski steel and lights it. So what about you, Antonis? Why are you here? When did you decide to live the life of a dissident?
Ha! I still haven't decided. Maybe I'll go live in the United States someday, meet a nice American girl with big breasts.
Be careful what you ask for, my friend.
How about another round? Thomas asks.
Konnichiwa, moi drug.
Thomas walks to the bar and orders reinforcements from lovely Luba. He rides the music on a nice buzz. As he pays Luba a couple of hundred for the drinks, the DJ finishes his set, and one of the party girls from the corner takes over the decks. Once she clamps on the headphones, she is all business, concentrating with a half-smile and closed eyes, one hand pressing the headset close to one ear, the other hand cueing the standby turntable. Her first track is a bouncy, beat-heavy track that sounds like an Eno remix with smooth vocals layered on top. The Russian vocals please Thomas. A girl's high, clear voice with no vibrato, overdubbed upon itself. He lets the song bounce him back to the table and hands one of the drinks to Antonis. As he sits down, Thomas sees the first DJ meandering through the crowd toward them. Antonis follows his gaze and smiles.
Ah, look who it is. Mstislav, he says. Mstislav, this is Thomas. He is just in from London and Petersburg. He will stay at the factory for a little while.
Welcome, says Mstislav. The DJ shines a blazing 30-mile-wide smile and presses Thomas's hand just a bit longer than he really needs to. Mstislav's eyes are hooded and dreamy, the pupils dilated so wide that Thomas can't tell the color of his eyes.
Cheers, says Thomas. Having a good night, I see?
It's a beautiful night, beautiful night.
Like to sit down, Gospodin? Asks Antonis.
Nah, I just want to dance.
What did you guys think about the set?
Brilliant, says Thomas.
Blinding, parrots Antonis.
I really like what she's been playing, too, offers Thomas, gesturing toward the new DJ.
Zhenya?
Yeah, she's amazing. I'd marry her if she'd let me.
Ha ha, we could call her Gospozhe Explodo. I could picture it,
laughs Antonis. Mstislav leans closer to Antonis now and says, barely loud enough to be heard over the music, "If you're interested, I have some treats. Pharmaceutical-grade MDMA. I picked it up in Russia a couple of weeks ago. Pressed, not capped." Antonis shrugs and smiles at Thomas. "What do you say?" Thomas feels the drink in his hand begin to tremble, and he places it on the table to keep it still. The question could have come from any night during the years he spent in San Francisco, and he's still not ready to think about that now. "Nah, it kills me to say no, but I can't. I need to work tomorrow." He takes a long drag from his cigarette. "Thomas just flew in tonight," explains Antonis, sounding disappointed. "He hasn't settled in yet." "Sure, sure, maybe I see you another night." Mstislav gestures languidly at Antonis with one hand. "Ante can find me." "Sure, looking forward to it." "Shall we?" asks Antonis after Mstislav wanders off. "I'll show you the factory." The factory is the basement of a closed hat factory on Ulitsa G. Adzhemushka. Antonis leads him into the darkness and then snaps on a painfully bright, unshaded ceiling bulb. When Thomas's eyes adjust, he surveys a large workroom with concrete floors, some work tables lined up against one wall that support printers, scanners, and two battered PCs. The PCs connect to the wall through a bulky, homemade-looking step-up, step-down voltage regulator. He's seen these before, in cities with dodgy power grids. The open space in the room has been turned into the secret burial ground for obsolete electronic musical instruments. At least that's what it looks like, with more than a dozen boxy, rugged-looking metal devices pushed together, most of them adorned with piano-style keyboards. Glossy posters advertising clubs and bands cover most of the concrete walls. A large poster above the room's age-darkened circular dial telephone depicts a fierce-eyed woman in a babushka, one finger placed against her pursed lips and the words "Не болтай" in Cyrillic below her face. The first of the PCs is making a faintly recurring beeping noise while the second displays a screensaver showing characters from Japanese animation, slim girls with multicolored hair. A small kitchen around the corner contains a sink, ancient mini-fridge, and single-burner electric hotpoint, while an adjoining room is just large enough to fit a field cot that might have once been green, and a wooden bookshelf straining under stacks of books and Western club magazines. "It's not high class, but it's free," says Antonis. "Hey, this is great. Thanks for letting me stay here," says Thomas. "Tell me, in the paperwork for your visa," Antonis asks, "you told the government you'd be staying at Hotel Chernomorskaya." "Yeah, I did." "And then you canceled your reservation at Chernomorskaya." "Yes. Will the hotel rat me out to the Interior Ministry?" "They won't bother. If you had kept the reservation and hadn't shown up, it would have been more trouble. Just don't let a policeman ask for your papers and then find out you're not staying where you're supposed to be." "What do I do if a cop does stop me?" "Give him a couple thousand rubles and he'll leave you alone. But only if he actually asks for your papers. Don't make it easy for the bastards. The best thing is just don't get stopped. Don't stay on the same sidewalk as a cop if you see one coming your way. They might shake you down just because you look like a foreigner, and they want some money." "Right, the usual." "Savali and I won't be in until late tomorrow, but you have my phone number if you need me during the day. Here's the spare key to the place." Antonis places a key on the desk. Thomas sits heavily on the cot in the other room as the Lada's motor Doppler shifts away. "Enough now." He lies down gratefully, still in his clothes. He realizes that he might be happy, that core biological happiness that comes with exhaustion and the first moment of rest. He has a bed and shelter from the cold, everything he needs at the moment. He's come to this country for a story about politics and money, for what he was afraid would have been an exercise in mindless repetition. He has instead been offered, what, ecstasy? In his fatigue and hash-altered state, he likes the metaphor. He thinks of the music, and Antonis, and little Luba, and Mr. Explodo, and smiles himself into a dreamless sleep. The world may be a good place, after all. The kids are going to be all right.
No way.